I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Bucks County District Attorney David Heckler recently announced a series of initiatives to address the problem of heroin and opiate use, addiction, and distribution in the county. His office said that the number of heroin-related deaths has doubled since 2012. It's a nationwide phenomenon that raises a whole host of concerns and questions, our topic for today's Radio Times. And we begin our conversation with David Heckler. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
You're welcome. Is the problem in Bucks County more users or a more lethal heroin or a combination of the two?
I believe it's a combination of the two. The DEA tells us that the Philadelphia region has some of the purest heroin the purest heroin in the nation, according to their information gathering, and some of the lowest prices for heroin in the nation. So that it's enormously available, and people are using it, abusing it.
Do you know how many heroin users in Bucks County? Is there any way to know that?
Not that I can think of. Obviously, it's a crime. People don't let us know that they're committing crimes. We obviously attempt to arrest and prosecute those who are, although that's a blunt instrument by which to deal with drug abuse. Our main focus of these endeavors is on those who are selling it and bringing it into our communities.
Well, I know that your office has established a drug tip line. What have you learned since that line has been established?
Well, nothing sweeping. We have had 42 hits, if you will, so far in terms of people providing information, which in some cases has led to arrests and certainly is being processed in terms of adding to our intelligence information. It's really a matter of engaging the community and making people realize that this is a very real problem, especially in the middle-class communities. There's a high level of denial.
And why do you think that is? Just the idea that heroin somehow is happening somewhere else or perhaps more associated with poor communities than a more middle-class community?
Exactly. There is a lack of understanding that it's so readily available. Kids do not see it as the this stuff is so pure you can snort it, in much the way cocaine is commonly used, and initially get a high. Now, that doesn't last, and eventually people who become addicted end up mainlining it, shooting it into their veins. But in order to keep chasing that high, which, of course, eventually goes away, and then you're fighting the sickness that comes if you don't take the drug. But people just don't, I think, comprehend that even at the middle school, and I'll guarantee you there are any number of elementary school kids in Bucks County who know what heroin is and could probably tell you where to get it.
Elementary school kids, meaning first to, what, sixth, eighth grade?
First through sixth or seventh grade.
So it,
definitely, it's in the middle schools.
If they know where to get it, do you know where it comes from?
Mexico, primarily, initially. One of the things that we endeavored to do with this program is get very specific about the suppliers. I can tell you parking lots you can go to in Philadelphia and where there'll be a car parked all day, and if you know what to look for, they're ready to deal. And there are also numbers you can call and get it delivered up here, not unlike pizza.
Not unlike pizza. I know you and others, and in fact we did a show about this last year, about the fact that people's medicine cabinets in their homes where parents have prescription drugs, that sometimes is a gateway to more serious drug use. Can you talk a bit about that?
That's one of the initiatives that, thanks to Mike, the Chief of County Detectives, Chris McAteer, and thanks initially to the DEA, we started several years ago. We've taken back better than 15 tons of pharmaceuticals, leftover pharmaceuticals. I'm sure some of that's fish oil and other things. But we encourage people, and I'll tell you what, I'm a senior citizen. Our generation has more aches and pains. We get more opioid pain relievers prescribed to us. You should assume, if you've got grandchildren who are in and out of your house, that, not saying anything about anybody's grandchildren, assume that those drugs will be examined and may well end up in some young person's insides. Get rid of them. If you're not actively using them, if they're left over, get rid of them. There happens to be a drug take-back the latest drug take-back will take place next Saturday. I believe that's the 26th. There are take-back points all over most of the municipal, either the police department or the township building throughout Bucks County. And we have about 40 drop boxes so that you can drop them off anytime. The Bucks County has a website. The DA's office has a website that can tell you where.
And that's Bucks County District Attorney David Heckler getting us started. We are talking about the problem of heroin in Bucks County. It's true in other counties as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499 if you want to give us a call. I know from some of the reporting on what you and your office is doing is that you really want to aggressively prosecute dealers. What legal tools do you have to do that?
Well, the legal tools are adequate, including mandatory sentences where significant quantities are delivered. The big key is getting the information that enables us to make valid arrests, and we are now questioning something that was done in my young prosecutorial life back in the 70s. A possessor, somebody who's pleading guilty to simple possession of drugs, will be asked, "Where'd you get them?" And will be expected by most judges to answer up, barring some special circumstances. We will track that information down. We're endeavoring. One of the tragedies, as you mentioned at the beginning, we're losing an ever greater number of primarily young people, not necessarily teenagers, but young adults, to heroin and other opioid overdoses. We're encouraging the police to treat each of those situations as a homicide, to process the scene. We of course help our county detectives assist in that process. We're looking for information, what is the stamp on the bag? Where did this stuff come from? Who may have administered it?
You're talking about then tracing an overdose death back to a dealer, and then charging that dealer, if you can find him or her, charging them with homicide.
Where possible. Obviously, we have to be able to prove that it was the drugs that person delivered actually caused the death. There are challenges to that, and where the drugs are administered by another user, there's a certain amount of resistance. We just actually prosecuted one of those cases this week, and won convictions on various counts, but not on the death by drug delivery. And I think that's a jury nullification. They're not going to hold another junkie who went out and bought where everybody's buying voluntarily to the same standard they would a drug dealer. That's understandable.
But do you think it's possible to sort of arrest and prosecute and imprison this problem?
Oh, it's. I have no illusion that we're going to make this go away. No. On the other hand, if we sit on our hands, it will get one heck of a lot worse. You're talking about containment here. It's not unlike Japanese beetles or any of a number of other pests that have arrived on our shores. We can't eradicate them, but if we don't take appropriate measures, the problem will only grow much more serious, in my view.
Is your office coordinating with, I'm thinking of county agencies that perhaps deal with treatment and deal with people who are using these drugs?
Well, we certainly, the emphasis of every one of our approaches, every individual prosecution, is on getting the offender appropriate treatment. We're not under the illusion that if you've got somebody who's using heroin, simply locking them up either in the county prison or in a state correctional facility is going to solve that problem. Although there is substantial emphasis on drug treatment in any of the incarcerated settings, but generally the sentence that is imposed is one of outpatient or inpatient drug treatment rather than incarceration. But if you don't have a prosecution and a conviction, you don't have the ability to hold the abuser accountable and require them to get treatment. And very, very rarely will they do so on their own.
Let me squeeze a caller in, Dave, before we have to say goodbye to you. This is Ryan from Bucks County. Ryan, if you can just put your question out there, that would be great. Go ahead.
Sure. So, hi.
Hi.
So, the problem of being caught here in Bucks County is quite often there's some sort of deal made, and they're asked to go out and get themselves involved to try to catch the big fish. And, and I think the emphasis should be more so on treatment and trying to find new programs, regardless of whether or not they're convicted or not. But if they're caught with it, they should definitely go into treatment. There's no doubt about it.
Well,
somehow you guys need to figure that out instead of sending them back out there to be your snitch, because I know that that backfires
Okay, Ryan, no, I appreciate the call. And Dave, what he's saying is the idea of using some of these users, as Ryan says, as a snitch. Is he right about that?
Well, that certainly happens from time to time. You're setting up a false tension, however, if you suggest that we want to use somebody as a snitch and actually keep them abusing as opposed to getting treatment. We may very well, for a brief period of time, have somebody call up a dealer, introduce our undercover, or arrange a deal. We're not talking about keeping somebody out there abusing drugs so that we can go chase other people. There's a danger that this stuff becomes circular. Our dealer, who was our target yesterday, becomes our friend today. But no, the emphasis is on getting treatment for individuals and getting them out of this life. But the dealers who don't abuse generally, who are doing this as a business, need to be brought to justice.
Well, on that note, Bucks County District Attorney David Heckler, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Church Christiana 100 supports WHYY and celebrates its 100th anniversary with a performance of Johann Sebastian Bach's St. Matthew Passion with orchestra on Good Friday, April 18th at 7 p.m. Christ Church's music program is known for its advancement of Anglican music and features an 18-voice professional choir. Conveniently located in Wilmington, St. Matthew Passion and the choir's 100th anniversary events at christchurchde.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a year ago, we spoke with the head of emergency at Boston Medical Center.
The first patient rolled in. He was near death. He had lost both of his legs, and we started to work on him, and then it was just one after another after another.
A year later, the caregivers still struggle. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
St. Joseph's University supports WHYY, presenting a symposium on the 25th anniversary of Tiananmen Square, April 23rd and 24th, bringing together leading experts on this event to share new interpretations and research and strategies for teaching and understanding the events of 1989 in China. Open to the public, no ticket required. Sponsored by Asian Studies at St. Joseph's University, the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations Public Intellectuals Program, and WHYY. More at sju.edu/ts25.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Heroin used to be associated with poor people and rundown neighborhoods, but as we just heard, it's a problem in bucolic Bucks County. The death this year of acclaimed actor Philip Seymour Hoffman from a lethal mix of drugs, including heroin, underscores that reality. Heroin use is on the rise, even though it's less popular than other illegal drugs. Attorney General Eric Holder said the increasing number of heroin deaths, though, is an urgent and growing health crisis. We asked Tom McClelland to join us for the rest of Radio Times in this hour. He's CEO and co-founder of the Treatment Research Institute, which is here in Philadelphia. They work on and develop science-based solutions to addiction. And he was science advisor and deputy director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy for the Obama administration. And Tom McClelland, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And from your perspective, why do you think heroin is on the rise?
Well, it is a logical and expectable consequence of the dramatic rise in prescription opioid use, not just in Pennsylvania, but throughout the country. Prescription opioids are now the major class of medications prescribed in the country. And overdose deaths from prescription opioids are now right in there with car accidents as the major cause of accidental death in the country. So prescription opioid use is basically heroin prep school. It's just sets you up for it.
Well, I mean, we're talking about the medicine cabinet here, right? We're not talking about what's in our medicine cabinet. Do you agree with David Heckler that if you have opioids that are sitting around your medicine cabinet and you're not using them, get rid of them?
Absolutely
take them to the
right.
Cops?
I thought he made a lot of sense. That's absolutely correct.
Is heroin cheaper than these opioids?
Yes, it is. You're buying opiates, and just stands to reason that a processor who has no government regulation, no restrictions, can put more of that opiate into a product and do it in a cheaper way than a pharmaceutical firm.
And is it also true that Philadelphia, this region, is a very popular place for heroin?
Well, I'd like to say it's unusual, but I now see it in Ohio. I see it in Kansas. I see it in places that have never had it. So it's certainly bad. But I don't think Philadelphia or Pennsylvania is any different than a lot of other states.
And does it come from Mexico? And is that the source of it, or is it worldwide?
It's worldwide. It's interesting. A lot of people think that the heroin comes from Afghanistan. That's not true. The demand is so great in Russia and Poland and Eastern Europe that they take all of the Afghanistan heroin. So, yeah, it comes up from the South America through Mexico.
What is the heroin high? I mean, what is that experience?
Well, if for your listeners who've had a pain problem, let's say an acute care pain problem, they've got Percocet or any of the opiates. If you're under pain, you experience this terrific sense of relief. But if you take that medication when you're not in pain, you're going to have an entirely different sensation. Depending upon your genes, you may have a sense of not just euphoria, but just a sense of peace and a feeling that you've never really experienced before.
I mean, is it short-lasting, long-lasting, fades
depends,
over time?
Of course, on the dose and the route of administration, but an opiate can last 2 hours to, depending upon the medication, 24 hours.
Are there people that can take heroin without worrying about addiction?
Yes, and that's important to say. If you're receiving an opioid prescription for a pain problem and you're taking it in a manner that is consonant with what your doctor tells you, you're probably fine, especially if you have had no family history of any kind of addiction or serious mental health problem. You're probably fine. If any of those things are not true, if you're not taking it as prescribed, if you're taking it a different route of administration, if you've got a bad history, you've got to watch yourself.
Do we know what percentage of the population, I mean, if it runs in families, what percentage of the population is at risk then for addiction, even moving beyond heroin, but just talking about drugs and alcohol?
Round numbers, 10%. Roughly 12% of males, about 7 or 8% of women. The genetic risk for addiction, not use, but addiction, the illness of addiction, is about the same as the genetic risk for diabetes, hypertension, or asthma. It's a chronic illness, and it's genetically mediated. You've got to use to become addicted, but not everybody who uses gets addicted.
And from your perspective and from the research that you've done and others have done, we're talking about a disease here.
Yeah, addiction is definitely a disease. A lot of people confuse that. They think addiction is just a lot of drug use, drug partying. No. There is a switch that gets flipped. We don't know where that switch is. We don't know what flips it. We don't know why a certain kind of a person and not another will have that flipped. But once that happens, you have a chronic illness and one that is going to require management and monitoring for the rest of your life, just like diabetes or hypertension or any other chronic illness.
And when you say a switch that is flipped, is it just like, boom, you're addicted?
That's not particularly clear either. We know that switch is a genetic one. A certain amount of use will express a gene. And once that gene is expressed, it's not just one gene. There are several genes involved. Once those genes are expressed, and it doesn't matter if it's marijuana, alcohol, cocaine, or opiates, you can't put that toothpaste back in the tube, you know?
Your family has had to deal with addiction. I mean, in certain ways, it puts you in a very unique position.
Yeah.
You had a son that died of an overdose.
And I have a son who's in long-term recovery from addiction. So, yeah, and people think, oh, that's probably why you got into this field. And not at all. I never even noticed it. I'm completely oblivious to it. I got into this field simply because I couldn't get a job anywhere else.
Truly?
Yep. I got out of, I think every well-educated American has probably read my PhD thesis on animal learning, but I couldn't get a job in animal learning, and I was very fortunate to get a job I really loved at the Coatesville Veterans Administration Medical Center.
Sure, outside working, of Philly.
Right, working with a brand new thing called drug addiction treatment.
But as you said, even with your own sons, you didn't know.
And I didn't see it.
Yeah, and I don't think you're alone in that. I think within a family, sometimes you don't see it because they cover it up, or you don't see it because you don't want to see it.
Yeah, and that's the only reason I reveal it. Believe me, it's no pleasure to reveal it. But I think to myself, if a guy who's been dealing with this for, at the time, 20 years, and was, I published about it and everything else. I didn't see it. How's a school bus driver? How's a radio show host? How does anybody do it? So the shame is not that it happened. The shame is not doing something about it, because there are many things we can now do to overcome this terrible disease.
And shame is, it's almost painful to say the word shame. It's so shameful.
Yeah, it's tough. But I take great comfort in the AIDS issue, because there's no more stigmatized, disenfranchised, segregated set of people ever than the AIDS community. It was not considered an illness when it was a lifestyle, just like addiction was not considered an illness. And those people with AIDS organized. They got together. They put aside their internecine differences. They demanded quality care. They demanded that care be integrated into the rest of health care. They demanded research. They got it. And now AIDS is a chronic illness. It's not a death sentence.
But taking that example, I mean, what you're saying is that people who are addicted for whatever reason, what should come out and organize? Families should come out and organize.
Yeah.
Don't be so quiet. Don't be so private about it. Don't be so secretive.
Especially now. A truly historic thing happened this year. This is the 100-year anniversary of the Harrison Narcotic Act, which took addiction out of the hands of doctors and put it into the criminal justice system. Well, in 2014, you have the Affordable Care Act and the Parity Act. For the first time in my lifetime, addiction is going to be treated in the same way with the same benefits as any other illness. But it'll only happen if the affected people and their families stand up and demand it. They have to.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Tom McClellan, and he's the CEO, co-founder of the Treatment Research Institute that's here in Philadelphia. Again, he works on, the Institute works on and develops science-based solutions to addiction, and he worked in the Obama White House. He was science advisor, deputy director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, joining us in this hour of Radio Times, talking about addiction and what we know about it, how to treat it, how to be more open about it, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. But I do want to get to our callers, but are you also saying that there is treatment that does work?
Oh, yeah. It is recovery. Sustained, stable recovery is now an expectable result of good treatment. Notice I didn't say cure. You don't cure diabetes or hypertension either, but you can manage it and you can remain symptom-free and highly functional, tax-paying, healthy person. But you have to demand good quality care.
But what does that look like? What does that include?
Good quality care is not acute care. So much of that crap is sold over and over and over. The quick fix, it doesn't exist. You need to first stabilize. You got to get rid of your withdrawal symptoms, and people think, okay, so that's it, I've done. No, that's the beginning. It's like stabilization after a heart attack. You get stabilized, but then you have to change the way you live. And the way you change is with monitoring, management, support services. It's not that expensive. It works very, very well. The best is for addicted doctors and addicted airline pilots. They have a higher proportion of people affected by addiction than the rest of the population. 12 to 15% are affected. They have 85 to 90% success rates out 5 years. We evaluated them. I know it's true.
You need good clinicians to be able to do that. Do we have good clinicians?
We don't have enough. And we have an antiquated acute care system that hasn't been financed to give that kind of chronic care. We have chronic care in primary medicine. Every primary care doctor knows how to do chronic care for diabetes and hypertension and pain, but they've never been trained in addiction. So we have to merge those two systems so that good chronic care can be delivered by people who know what they're doing.
Let me get some callers in the conversation. It looks like our phones have exploded. We have Scott from Narberth, Pennsylvania, to join us. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Marty. Hi, Tom. It's Scott Burris from Temple Law School.
Hi there.
I've been working on the overdose issue for a long time, and it's something I wanted to bring up both for Tom, because it's something that Tom's office at the ONDCP has recommended and something that's happening in Pennsylvania now. And that's how to stop people from dying once they have an overdose.
Right.
Mr. Heckler talked about prosecuting people who gave drugs to other people, but the real approach that's making a dent in overdose now, and not just here in the U.S., but across the world where this is a problem, is what's called the Good Samaritan Law, which promises that if people will call for help when they're at an overdose scene, they won't be arrested or charged, because otherwise users are afraid that they'll get in trouble if they call, especially young people. So that's one thing. And then another part of the law that's now up in the Pennsylvania General Assembly is to distribute the antidote for overdose called naloxone to both drug users and to their families who are worried that their kids might be at risk of overdose. And that, too, requires some legislation. About half the states have done it now, and the Office of National Drug Policy has recommended it. So that's something we could do in Pennsylvania right now this spring to make a dent in the death rate.
Scott, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Tom, you're nodding your head.
I'm nodding my head vigorously. Dr. Burris is completely correct. He's an expert in his own right, and he is totally right. That will reduce these devastating effects of opioid overdose deaths. Naloxone, particularly, you can spray it in somebody who's already been passed out, and they spray it up their nostril, and it's truly magical. It'll eliminate the opioid and bring them back into function. By the way, you then need to take them for care, but it will save their lives. And along with the Good Samaritan Act, those are things that have to be put into play.
But are you saying a friend could do that? We could carry around little EpiPen, something like that?
That's one way to do it. They have an EpiPen. You just literally stab them in the thigh, and it'll inject it. Another way is a spray up the nostril. Yep. It's cheap. It's easy to do. It would save a lot of lives.
Scott, again, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You wrote an interesting piece after the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman. He died of a drug overdose. You had a piece in Huffington Post, Healthy Living. And I'm just quoting here from what you wrote: overdosing on heroin doesn't make you a scumbag. Mm. Having a drink after 20 years of sobriety doesn't make you weak. Having an addiction is not a moral choice. In fact, I think it's accurate to say that having an addiction is not a choice at all. But you wrote this because a journalist was actually interviewing you about this, and they said something you can't say on the radio,
right,
but said something that truly offended you.
Really offended me. I mean, it was a very sort of heartwarming discussion about addiction and all that, followed by this individual was putting his coat on. He just says, yeah, that guy, what a scumbag. He, you know, just gave up. And I thought, my goodness, how callous a way of thinking that. You have to understand something. An addicted person, particularly an alcoholic, they have a genetic predisposition. There is no doubt that they made choices to start. They made those choices when they were 14, 15, 16 years old, just like I did, just like many of your listeners did. But they have a genetic predisposition, and once they started to use, they had they expressed genes and produced an addiction. By the way, I don't see it as being all that different than a person with a genetic predisposition for diabetes who eats their way into diabetes. Now, are these people scumbags if they succumb to this? I just, it's offensive to me.
Well, and what you said is and part of this article was, think of the many years that Philip Seymour Hoffman struggled against his addiction.
Right.
Not always successfully, right, obviously.
Not only that, think about the alcoholics. They struggle against addiction because every time they sit down for lunch, the waitress says, would you like a drink? We have Now, that's not easy to do. It takes courage. It takes persistence. That I applaud that, you know?
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. Again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about addiction. And you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And Tom McClellan is our guest, again, CEO and co-founder of the Treatment Research Institute. And he worked in the Obama administration, science advisor, deputy director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. We're talking about what we know about addiction. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from social justice community counseling or child and adolescent counseling. More information about a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
Can Ukraine go it alone against its own citizens who believe they have mighty Russia behind them? Ukraine was once part of the Soviet Empire. Is the black hole of history pulling them back? Putin, NATO, and the fragile Kiev government's options for suppressing the rebellion in eastern Ukraine. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the American Philosophical Society Museum, presenting Jefferson, Philadelphia, and the Founding of a Nation, opening April 17th. This exhibition explores Philadelphia through the lens of Jefferson as he wrote the Declaration of Independence and celebrates his long association with the city, featuring his handwritten draft of the Declaration with edits and annotations. Letters by Jefferson, Franklin, and others reference events leading to the writing of the Constitution. More at apsmuseum.org.
This is Radio Times. Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, we are talking about addiction. We had a caller that couldn't stay on the line. This is David from Philadelphia talking about prescription drugs. And Tommy had a question about Vivitrol. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. That's an excellent topic. Vivitrol is the trade name for what is long-acting naltrexone. Now, opiates affect the opiate system in your body. And heroin, any of the prescription opiates, occupy those receptors and give you a high. Well, Vivitrol, naltrexone, also occupies those receptors, but it knocks the heroin off and it stays there, binds tightly, so that anybody who decides, I think I will use heroin, they will not be able to feel it. They won't have any effect whatsoever. An injection of Vivitrol is it's expensive. It's about $1,200, wow. But it lasts for 30 days, and you will not be able to feel the effects of any opiate. You will not overdose. It's very, very useful, and it is almost never used.
Why is that?
Insurers won't cover it. Most physicians don't know anything about it. They haven't been educated about it in school. There are 164 medical schools in this country. 7 of them have a course in addiction. So there are many of these programs now that should be available and simply are not.
And is it a way? I mean, is it part sort of a detox? It's sort of getting someone off.
You have to detox first. If you take this shot while you're actively addicted, you will have the worst withdrawal you've ever had because it will knock all your opiates right off of your system.
Let me get, it looks like Shelley from Kennett Square to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Shelley, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, I kind of what you were just speaking to. I didn't know if you could talk about sort of the financial commitment that families go through, putting their loved ones through recovery. My family, my parents, there isn't a rule book, so my parents tried to send them to the nicest places that are very expensive.
And Shelley, you're talking about your brother, right?
Right.
Okay.
He's actually in long-term recovery house in Florida now. But, you know, then they tried the tough love thing. He's homeless in Kensington shooting up. So, and then they have the whole going to jail and then can't get a job because he's a felon. So I didn't know if you could speak to sort of the financial commitment that families go through and the fact that there really isn't a rule book for how to get your family member sober.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times financial, and it sounds like psychological as well. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, yeah. And it's a crying shame. I just had a call from a CFO for a major healthcare system, and he had his son go through 5 different rehabilitations, paid cash for everyone. It's $150,000. Son had relapsed almost immediately. Son had never heard, neither he nor his son had ever heard of any medication that was available. So the problems are many. Number one, you have a segregated healthcare system for addiction. It's not connected to the rest of medicine. So there have been camps form. There's the rehabilitation, rehab facility camp. There's the medication camp. There's the harm reduction camp. They fight like cats, and they are all part of the solution, but they haven't come together. Two, you have an insurance problem. Insurance has skated past this quite willfully. They have relegated very little money to this. They've not called it an illness. And they, you don't have equitable insurance. That's going to be fixed with the Parity Act and the Affordable Care Act, but it's, again, going to take demand. Finally, because there have been such small demand, even though the problem is huge, there's as many addicted people as there are people with diabetes in this country, there are very, very little demand. So pharmaceutical firms haven't stepped up and even allowed some of their effective medications to be used. So I notice that I'm not given an answer here.
I was going to ask you, and we have Shelby and her family.
Yeah, I am simply restating the problem. The kind of care you need is protracted, long-term, outpatient care. It often needs to be preceded by a detoxification and a period of residential stabilization, often. But it definitely needs continued care by and management by an informed family and an informed physician and a primary care team. Those things don't exist mostly.
Shelby, I do appreciate the call to Radio Times. I wish we could solve your problem, frankly. But, Tom, there used to be, I don't know if it's still true today, that an addict has to, quote-unquote, bottom out before there's any chance that they might want to think about recovery. Does that hold up?
I think that is among the biggest crocks ever put forward in this field. Please tell me another illness where you say, well, you know, for a diabetic to really get it, he first has to have a coma or he has to lose his fingers. Come on. You know what that is? That's another way of saying that we don't have treatments that are attractive enough and engaging enough to get people before they lose everything. Now, those are starting. They're coming along. But we haven't been as attractive and engaging to this disease as we have for many others.
I know the Institute has come out with a consumer guide to adolescent treatment. I guess the idea of figuring out what works and putting it together.
Right, exactly. I was in the same situation as Shelley was, except that I was an expert in addiction, and even I didn't know where to send my own family members to treatment. That is a crying shame. You know how to buy a refrigerator. You know how to buy an insurance policy. There's comparative consumer information. Well, Kathy Myers and John Cassiola at the Treatment Research Institute worked very hard with the people from Drug Strategies and Consumers Report.
Really?
And we now have a way of measuring the quality. It's not a bunch of thumbs up, thumbs down. These are objective measures of the quality of care. We're putting it on a website, and we're trying to get enough money so that Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, and Maryland can put these up so that people like Shelley's family can at least go and see what's available.
And you're talking about naming names? I mean, this facility, this is their recovery rate or something like that?
If you want a quality product, you have to have an informed set of consumers, and we don't. It's like the funeral industry. You got this terrible, distraught time. Fantastic promises are made. No insurance dollars. It's tough.
Let me get Phyllis from Cape May, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Hi, Phyllis. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. My question was, I really like what you're saying about everything, but would you have more success with addiction care if you took the entire addiction arena and drug availability and the addicts and their dealers completely out of the crime arena? Mm-hmm. Like you said, it was taken away from the crime arena or put into the crime arena 100 years ago and out of the medical. Well, how about completely reversing that, taking all the crime out of it and putting it totally back into the medical arena where the illegal drugs are available to addicts if they need them, and treatment, if that's what the case is, and completely take all the illegal business, which is a huge income-producing business, too. Would that have more success if that were done?
Thanks, Phyllis. Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
I'm sorry. I just don't think so. It's widely believed. I don't think so. Just think of it this way. You need to have users in order to have addicts. Now, not everybody that uses is going to become addicted, but that's where it starts. Now, for any product that you want to have, I don't care if it's Hershey bars or iPhones or whatever, if you increase the availability, you reduce the price, you increase the access, you're going to have more users. and those who use are going to use more. So anything you do, like legalization, for example, or reducing penalties for use, I think are going to just increase the number of people who use. Now, I am not one who believes that you can incarcerate your way out of this. Clearly, that doesn't work. But legalization or eliminating, as you say, the criminal thing is simply going to make more drugs available. I don't know how you'll treat it when there's full ready availability of drugs.
But if we're only talking about a minority of drug users, as you said, there's some people that can probably use heroin and not get addicted. If we're talking about, let's say, 10% of the population, even if you were to legalize drugs, would that increase the number of people who would be addicted, do you think?
Yeah, it absolutely would. If, for example, 10% of users become addicted, then anything you do to increase the number, array, type, of drugs available is going to increase the number of people from whom 10% are going to become addicted. Mm. And that's just addiction. Let's not forget the drug-related crimes. Let's not forget the drug-related injuries, accidents, things that happen. Those things happen every Friday and Saturday night. Addiction takes 5 or 7 years.
But what we have today clearly is not working.
Not working. Nope, not working. My view, for what it's worth, is decriminalization. I like the idea of more rapid, modest sanctions, and that actually make the city and make the state some money. If you do this right, you'll make money on sanctioning drug and alcohol offenders. You won't incarcerate them. That loses you money, and it makes them a permanent cast of outcasts.
Let me get Olga from Warminster to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Olga. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I mainly had a comment. My whole thing is I've used heroin for over 10 years.
Wow.
I've been clean with methadone for the last 4.
Good.
And my whole thing is, from what I've seen, there's stages that drug addicts go through. There's a beginning stage where someone starts using. They are having fun. They're falling deeper and deeper into their addiction. There's a middle where you're chasing your addiction, and there's the end, where a person is struggling, they don't want to do it anymore, but they don't know how to get out of the situation they're in. What people like your guest needs to focus on is the beginning and the end. The people in the middle who are chasing that high, they're not ready to stop. They're not going to want to stop. Anytime I've seen people forced into treatment that are in that stage, it just doesn't end well. You end up spending so much money and so many resources trying to get these people clean, where in the end they're either sitting in jail or in treatment that was forced upon them, counting down the days until they get out just to use again. I've seen it time and time again personally. So I feel that maybe if more resources were focused on those people who are just starting out, just to grab them real quick, or to help the people that are trying to stop after many years, you would have a lot more success rate. But in the middle, those people, until they don't want to use, until something in their head just snaps and tells them, that's it, I'm done, you can't make someone stop.
Well, Olga,
you just can't.
First of all, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and she put some interesting questions to you,
yeah,
Tom.
Yeah, and I at least half agree with her. She's absolutely right. The best place to devote your energies in the most cost-effective way is before it starts. And by the way, there are very, very effective methods of prevention. I hear it all the time. Prevention is being discredited. There are communities in Pennsylvania, 26 of them, as a matter of fact, where evidence-based prevention has been put into play, and they have 40 to 50% less of every drug and alcohol-related problem than neighboring communities that are demographically quite similar. You can prevent this. Okay?
So, what is that?
You organize the community the school, the police, the business people, the parents, to each take responsibility for their sector, to coordinate that work, and you give each of those sectors evidence-based tools, the right kind of educational information, the right kind of policies within the community. And again, this is not my opinion. It reduces or delays drug use among kids by 40 to 50%. And we're not doing near enough. So I agree with Olga on that. I also agree with the end. There's far more needs to be done with people who have decided to quit. They need easier access. They need the ability to continue and maintain the care that is effective in reducing their substance use. But I'm afraid I still don't buy her argument. I mean, every single day, some product or service is sold to people who weren't really thinking about wanting to buy it, and they make an attractive proposition, and the person goes for it. We could attract a lot more people to get into that stage earlier. And I think that's worth doing.
Well, and we're almost out of time here. It sounds like from her perspective, she sees people being forced into treatment and they're just sort of counting the hours until it's over.
Yeah.
You're saying make treatment more attractive?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Look at all the things that I always use diabetes. Look at all the things that you can have if you're diabetic. You don't just have to go on insulin, and you don't have to use the same kind of injection that your grandmother did. They're all array of things. And do you know what that's done? It's gotten people into care earlier. It's kept them into care longer. It's made them more compliant, and it's reduced the burden to everybody in the healthcare system, and it's prolonged their lives. We can do the same thing with addiction.
Olga, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Tom McClellan, thank you very much for joining us as well, giving us a lot to talk about and think about. He's CEO and co-founder of the Treatment Research Institute here in Philadelphia. And again, from 2009 to 2010, was science advisor, deputy director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and find out more about this program, including Twitter, Facebook, podcast, email, satellite radio, and the archive. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.